Good evening, everyone, and welcome, thank you, and welcome to the kickoff event for Silicon Valley Reads 2012, presented by the Santa Clara County Office of Education, Santa Clara County Library, San Jose Public Library Foundation, and the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley. My name is Judy Kleinberg, and I'm the program director for the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation for Silicon Valley. The Knight Foundation is dedicated to creating informed and engaged communities and leveraging the cultural diversity of Silicon Valley as a powerful community asset. So we're very proud to be one of the major sponsors of Silicon Valley Reads. It's my pleasure to introduce the authors of this year's Silicon Valley Reads selections, Sumbul Ali Karmali and G. Willow Wilson. Sumbul grew up in Southern California and received her undergraduate degree from Stanford University and her law degree from UC Davis. She practiced She practiced corporate law in San Francisco, much better, and later moved to England, where she began her formal studying of Islam at the University of London School of Oriental and African Studies. After earning her Master's of Law degree, Sumbul remained in London, where she worked at the university and the Center of Islamic and Middle Eastern Law. Sumbul serves on the Board of Trustees of a nonprofit education institution that teaches multicultural education and environmental education to children, and is on the steering committee of Women in Islamic Spirituality and Equality. She was also awarded Santa Clara County's Asian American Hero Award for her work in fostering cross-cultural understanding and education. Sumbul is the author of The Muslim Next Door, The Quran, The Media, and That Veil Thing. Welcome. G. Willow Wilson grew up in Colorado, and after graduating from Boston University with a degree in history and coursework in Arabic language and literature, moved to Cairo to teach. She was the first Western writer to interview Sheikh Ali Goma, the current Mufti of Egypt, and one of the most influential clerics in modern Islam. Her articles about modern religion and the Middle East have appeared in publications including The Washington Post, Atlantic Monthly, The New York Times Magazine, and the Canada National Post. Willow is a convert to Islam, and her commentary often addresses Islamic and interfaith issues. An avid supporter of new and alternative media, Willow has written for politics and culture blogs from across the political spectrum. Since the age of 11, when she first picked up a copy of The Uncanny X-Men, Willow has been a dedicated reader of comics and graphic novels. Today, she writes for Marvel Comics, DC Comics, and its literary imprint, Vertigo. Willow is the author of The Butterfly Mosque. Welcome, Willow. Moderating tonight's conversation is Mike Cassidy, our wonderful local columnist for the San Jose Mercury News. So, ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Sumbul Ali Karmali and G. Willow Wilson and Mike Cassidy.
Well, thanks very much. I don't know if that's me. It's very ominous. That is me. I heard that one of the band members, which, you know, we have this marvelous high school band, which is always a lot of fun, was really excited to be before this big crowd in this fancy theater, and then was a little bummed out when he discovered that this was just a big book club. But I've always kind of liked that about Silicon Valley Reads. I like that, and I really like this theater. The last time I was in here actually was for a naturalization ceremony where people were being sworn in as citizens. And it seemed almost kind of appropriate to be back here for this, because that ceremony was all about identity and our different circles of identity, who belongs, who decides who belongs. And our books this year are have some of those themes in them, among others. But speaking about identity and our circles of identity, I've got to say that the Silicon Valley Reads folks have picked the perfect moderator to interview two American Muslim women. That's me, white, male, Catholic. I'm perfect. In fact, I'm so perfect that when I was growing up in the Chicago suburbs, I thought the world's two great religions were Catholicism and Protestants. Unless you count the Catholic sects. As I understood it, there were the Irish Catholics and the Roman Catholics. But anyway, enough about me. We should probably talk to these people who have taken the trouble to come and talk to us. Between them, they've written about being Muslim in America and being an American in a predominantly Muslim country. And in our post-9/11 world, I think what they've done is taken a certain amount of courage. I'd suggest that even for that courage and for presenting us with two memorable books, we should stop and give them a big hand to get started. So now on with our show. What do you guys want to talk about? All right, if I have to do all the work, I guess I will. I mean, the thing that's so great about this year's Silicon Valley Reads is that we have two books which in places echo each other's themes but are so different in their approach. Sambul, you've written a kind of a tour de force of Islam, of the history and the law and the culture. And Willow, you've written a moving memoir about Islam and about a lot more, I would say. And I'm just wondering where you guys found the inspiration for these books or where the idea to do this came from. You may have asked yourself that at times, but maybe I'll start with Sambul.
Mm-hmm. Can everybody hear me? Okay. I have the worst trouble with microphones. I can't tell you. I was speaking at the Commonwealth Club and the mic went out in the middle and I had to shout for the rest of the event. So I always check. In a way, you could say that this book, The Muslim Next Door, is a culmination of my whole life. People ask me how long it took me to write, and I'm never sure what to say because it's a culmination of my life. And the reason is because I grew up in Southern California at a time when people didn't really know anything about Islam and Muslims. I mean, are there any Star Trek fans out there? Star Trek fans? You know, the whole idea of first contact? You know, you see an alien species for the first time and you don't really know how to handle them? That was me. I was the alien species. And so I grew up, you know, and it was kind of a function of there's just this little window before they opened up the quotas in this country for immigrants to come. And so most first-generation Muslims actually are 2 or 3 years younger than I am. So I was just a tiny bit ahead, and it was enough that I was the first one. I was the only Muslim that most of my teachers and classmates knew. And, you know, this didn't come up so much in elementary school because you don't talk about religion on the playground, except if I went to a birthday party and I couldn't eat the pepperoni pizza, and then I'd have to explain why. But otherwise, it really didn't come up. But when it did, you know, I had to answer questions. Well, why don't you eat ham? And what's Muslim? And where's India? Which is where my family was from. And it really wasn't until I got to Stanford when I was living in the dorm and I was under scrutiny because everyone's living on top of each other in the dorms. And all of a sudden, and I suddenly I was having to deal with some of these questions like, well, how do I pray 5 times a day when I live 2 feet away from my roommate and I don't want her to notice? Or, you know, how do I figure out if there's pork in the dorm food when nobody knows what's in the dorm food at Stanford? And, you know, my first quarter, my dorm had a progressive drinking party.
Wow.
In my dorm, you know, where you go from one room to the next and sample a different alcoholic drink?
Oh, I see.
I don't drink alcohol.
I was going to say, we never had political affiliations with our drinking parties, but I get it.
Yes. So all these little issues that came up, and then I found myself having to explain a lot more why I didn't drink, why I didn't date, why, you know, what was this thing I was doing 5 times a day. And then went to law school, started practicing, and that's really when people started asking me, by this time, Islam was in the news a lot more than when I was a child. So by that time, people started asking me, well, do you know, have any books that you could recommend for me to understand Muslims? And there weren't. There were textbooks and the occasional Sufi poetry volume, and that's it. And so I thought, I'll just write a book. I'll write a primer on Islam, and then everything will be fine, and everybody will understand. And
not everybody's read it. I'm sure.
So when my husband's job took us to London, I decided to do a graduate degree in Islamic law from the University of London. And it was really eye-opening because I had grown up as a Muslim, but you know, the academic study of religion is always different from the cultural practice that everyone grows up with, a family practice of religion. And so then I came back and thought, well, okay, now I'll write this book. And then I had kids, but it was kind of a culmination of answering all those questions growing up and getting the degree and sort of having an inside practicing view as well as an academic view of Islam. Mm-hmm. And, you know, obviously things changed somewhat after 9/11. The atmosphere changed. I had to kind of start over. But
well, we'll get to that.
Shortly. Yeah.
Yeah.
But how's this?
Okay. I was making that weird hum before, so I was worried. But and what about you, Willow?
Okay. Mine works. You know, for me, it was less a feeling that I needed to communicate some urgent message, and more a sort of working through of things that had happened in my life that I almost wanted a better understanding of myself. Uh-huh. The book grew out of emails that I had been writing home to family and friends after I moved to Egypt, when I was so full of new things and new experiences and being in a new country that it was all just sort of pouring out of me in these letters. And I had not traveled a great deal before I moved to Egypt. You know, I'd been, I think, the furthest away I'd been into international territory was like Toronto.
Uh-huh.
So it was a really big leap for me, and it was very eye-opening. And, you know, after I had been writing these sort of chain emails back in the dark days when, you know, it wasn't that long ago, but it was pre-Google Plus and all that stuff.
AOL.
When you really, if you wanted to write it, you know, an email, you just sort of, you had to write like a letter.
Right.
And so I had this collection of letters that I'd written about the people that I had met and the things I was thinking about. And three different friends that I knew wrote to me on within a few days of each other and said, why don't you put this together into a book? This is really interesting.
Oh.
And so that's how The Butterfly Mosque was born. It started out almost as sort of a travelogue of these notes and these letters put together and evolved into a memoir, a term that I hate because it makes me feel old. You know, I feel like memoir...
It's a shorter book.
Yeah, yeah. I feel like, you know, a memoir is something you write after you've had a long diplomatic career and everybody who could possibly be offended is already dead.
Yeah.
So I use that term sparingly, but that's what it is. You know, it's really... it's about Islam as a lived experience. You know,
mm-hmm.
I didn't have as much to say really about Islam as a set of rules and diktats and this kind of thing. What I was interested in, and the reason I went to Egypt in the first place, is because I wanted to see what Islam was like emotionally and culturally and
right.
interpersonally.
Huh.
And that's where the book came from.
Well, you know, you don't strike me as someone who does things halfway. I mean, you don't just convert. You convert to Islam and you move to Egypt. And you don't just move to Egypt. You move to Egypt and marry an Egyptian. And then you bring him back here. I'm just curious, what's your routine these days? Where?
Oh, my God. it's true. It's true. My personality is like that. I can't stand half understanding things.
Uh-huh.
And I can't stand half expressing things. And I've always been like that. And it's gotten me into a lot of trouble, and also given me a lot of interesting and unique opportunities. But surprisingly, my day-to-day life is incredibly boring. You know, my 11th-month-old wakes me up at 7 a.m.
Yeah,
I drag myself out of bed. you know, I write, I cook, I do kung fu. That's the most interesting thing do these days.
Yeah, sounds like a comic book character. Are you splitting your time between Egypt and the U.S. or?
You know, since my daughter was born, I haven't been back. The last time I was back was when I was pregnant with her, which would have been last fall. So this was just a few months before the revolution,
right.
Which nobody saw coming at that point. I mean, including the people who started it.
Wow, that's a good point.
But it's funny. I did a reading last time I was there at a little English language bookstore in Cairo, and it was packed, and there were some really great young people in there who were 18 and 19 and even younger, and they had such interesting ideas, and they were so... There was a dynamic there that I didn't see in the older generation, that they were sort of open to Western art forms and new media and the internet, and yet they were not interested in leaving behind their roots. They were not interested in turning their back on their religion or their culture. And it was the first time that I'd really felt like I had a place in that kind of mixture, because... I was not going to give up comic books. You know, not going to give up the internet, and I'm an internet junkie. As you know, if you follow me on Twitter, it's like I live there because I do. And I said, my God, this is really going to happen. This admixture is really going to come together.
That's interesting. Yeah.
And, you know, 6 months later, those same kids were overthrowing the government.
Right.
So it was pretty amazing.
The kids and Twitter, there you go.
Yep.
And we will get back to that, but it's interesting. You mentioned your child, and you both have children, and... I'm wondering if you think, what do you think it will be like for them growing up Muslim? Will it? Do you think it'll be easier for them to live their faith in the U.S. or wherever they may end up? As we sometimes our children leave us far behind. Go ahead. Sure.
I think they have a different situation to deal with. When I was a kid, a lot of what I dealt with was benevolent ignorance, and which was difficult sometimes. I went to school one time when I was fasting, only to find that I had to run the mile for the presidential physical fitness test.
Right, yeah.
And then you're like, what do I do? Do I tell him? Because he has never heard of Islam. And that was difficult. But I didn't have to deal with really much hostility. I mean, the only time I had to deal with hostility was when people got mixed up between the Nation of Islam and Islam, which were two different things.
Yeah.
And then there would be some confusing hostility. But generally, it wasn't so bad. There wasn't all this stuff in the media. And the Iranian Revolution was really what changed everything. And so my kids have a lot more statements to deal with, I think, from other people and from teachers. You know, my nephew had a knife pulled on him at his private all-boys college prep school, and the kid accused him of being an Islamic terrorist. So it's a different world, different challenges.
I don't know. You've only had 11 months to think about it. No, I'm kidding. But do you have thoughts about that?
You know, what I worry about for my daughter is two things. Both the way that Muslims are perceived in the U.S. and the way that Americans are perceived abroad. Because I feel like she's got sort of the brunt of what's wrong with the world today on her little shoulders, because she's half Arab and half American. And she's living in a world that tells her that she can't be proud of either one of those things. And that's what is most sad to me. And in a way, that's why I do what I do, which is a little bit more pop cultural, I guess, is the politest way to say it. you know, than the kind of thing that Symbol writes. But I feel like I need to make a collection of stories that cross that border, so that by the time she's old enough to read them, that there's something there for her, that there's literature there, that somebody has sort of started the path that she can walk on.
Well, that's interesting, yeah. To move on to another uplifting topic, but, I was very interested that we happened to be meeting on the one-year anniversary of the beginning of, at least in Egypt, of the Arab Spring and all. And I'm wondering what you guys are, think about what's going on in the Arab world and maybe particularly in Egypt. Do you see a change for the better coming, or is it? Can you tell yet? I mean, it's a little bit of a mixed story right now.
It is. I think, you know, revolutions are funny. In the Iranian Revolution, which Sumbul brought up, which was such a turning point both in the Middle East and here at home in terms of the perception of Muslims and of Arabs and Persians and Pakistanis and everybody. You know, when it started out, it did not start out as the Islamic Revolution. It was a revolution. There were communists, right. There were leftists, there were Islamists, there were middle-class people, poor people, rich people. And it was only after people saw sort of where all the chips had fallen that it became clear that the Islamists had the upper hand, and this was a totally new direction for Iran. And I think in the Arab Spring, there's a similar sense of unknowing right now what the ultimate resolution will be and what ultimately the Middle East will look like once these revolutions have sort of run their course. I think now, after the example that has been set by Iran and in Somalia and in Saudi Arabia and some other places, people in the Middle East are much more wary that this sort of panacea that Islam is the solution, but we're not going to tell you what Islam is before we implement it. They're much more wary of that. They're much more educated. The discussion has broadened a lot. So I think the fears that some people have that, oh, my God, we're going to get these horribly hostile regimes where, you know, they'll cut off your head if you look at people funny. I think that's an overblown fear. But I think there is a lot of uncertainty, and it will take a while to resolve.
Sumbul, do you have some thoughts on that? I'm wondering too whether is the rise of social media perhaps some cause for optimism in that when you talk about the discussion widening, that's certainly one way a discussion can widen.
Well, unlike Willow, I'm not an internet junkie, and Facebook really scares me. So I just have to put that out on the table right now. But going back,
why you didn't friend me?
It's a smarter move. So stay off of Facebook.
But you know, my middle school daughter's social studies teacher is really wonderful, and one of the things that he said is that people forget in this country is after the American Revolution, for 7 years, this country was very unstable and could have fallen at any time. And it really didn't become a democracy for 7 years. And I wish more people were aware of that, because people have said to me, well, you know, Egypt, it's already been a year. What are they doing?
Yeah.
And you know, I think it takes time, and you have to be patient, and you can't look for quick results, because that's when the powerful people take over. I see a lot of signs of encouragement, though. So I think what was happening in 1979, during the Iranian Revolution, like what Willow said, it was not a religious revolution. It was mostly just a move to get rid of the Shah, who was brutal. And it just happened that Khomeini and the religious scholars got the power, because they had been setting up social services for the landless poor. You know, they had been, you know, the religious scholars were on their side. That's how they did it. But also in the 70s and 80s, there was a rise in fundamentalism throughout all religions. You know, that's when you had Jerry Falwell and all these televangelists. That's where you had the rise of Hindu fundamentalism and Muslim fundamentalism and all of these fundamentalisms. Since then, I think things have relaxed. There's been now pushback against some of the Saudi tenets, for example. And so in Tunisia, what's very interesting is that the so-called, what's described as the Islamist Party, is actually much more pluralistic than the so-called secular party. The secular party just wants only the secularists and nobody else, whereas the so-called Islamist party wants everybody, the secularists, the, you know, people who want religion as a what as however they want it. It's not clear exactly what how prominent a force it's going to be. So I think what they're realizing is if you want a real democracy, you have to let everybody be part of the political process.
Go ahead.
No, I think that's a great step, and I think it's really, I feel very optimistic about it.
Is my perception that the role of women has been more prominent? Is that accurate, or I guess I'm thinking primarily of Egypt, but in general?
It seems to be the case, certainly. You know, women were critical in mobilizing people in Egypt. You know, it's women have always been, since the days of the previous Egyptian revolution, and even back to the constitutional revolution in the early 1900s, a critical part of the political process. But I think in this case, especially, where in order to throw, because now, you know, this is a military regime, they had guns, they needed everybody on the street, or it wasn't going to happen. And everybody knew it, the secularists knew it, the Islamists knew it. And so women played a hugely important role in mobilizing and in overthrowing the Mubarak regime. I think the question now is, will that hold in the election of the new government, in the formation of a new constitution? Mubarak, because he was an autocrat, could do things like set quotas for the minimum number of women that had to be elected to parliament. And so by law, I think it was 30% of the Egyptian parliament had to be women. The seats had to be filled by women. But in the wake of the revolution, those kind of autocratic and yet in a strange way useful, you know, systems no longer exist. And so it'll be interesting. And I think, you know, they're not done. They're not done. And women's groups have been very active in the years since the revolution.
What do you see the role of women as in the Arab Spring?
Well, you know, I've always seen the role of women maybe more than a lot of people have, because I work with one group which is called Women in Islamic Spirituality and Equality, and I'm also on what is called a Global Muslim Women's Shura Council, which is a council of Muslim women scholars who research issues pertaining to women and issue statements about them. So, and the role the purpose of both of these groups is really to promote women's rights from an Islamic perspective. And I mean, you might say, why from an Islamic perspective? And my answer is, promoting women's rights from any perspective is what is important. But so I do see a lot of women who have been working for years in politics, in activism, in all kinds of ways, in trying to change cultural tribal laws. Primarily, we haven't, like, for example, we partnered with an organization in Egypt, a nonprofit that would go out and offer economic alternatives to some of the damaging practices that people were doing. So I see women as always having been active.
Uh-huh. Okay. Well, this is great. We are getting a number of questions from the audience on these cards, and I will get to them, but I'm kind of selfish. I have a whole... anyway. But we will get to them, and it's helpful to be able to have the cards as we do, because this is being broadcast on the radio. So if you have any questions for Sumbal Ali Karamali or G. Willow Wilson, jot them down, and I'll get to them. I'll get to some of them. But I wanted to talk a little bit about the media, because I am the media. And you both, I think, were kind of hard on the media in your books, the evil lamestream media. You're criticizing the media for being insensitive to Islam, or maybe worse. And Sumbal, I have to say, I found myself feeling a little defensive at times, maybe more than once, reading The Muslim Next Door. And it doesn't take much to get me defensive, but I'm wondering, you know, what is the crux of your complaint about the way Islam and Muslims are covered in the press?
So you want me to condense a third of my book down into a couple sentences?
That's kind of how I got through college.
Well, you know, I think... And I've been in media, too. You know, I have been on CNN, where you have to answer everything in 20 seconds or less.
Yeah.
And I think there are lots of different factors about the media that result in what's going on. And I'm not saying it's evil purposely. You know, I'm not saying that the media goes out and tries to denigrate Muslims. But I think that the structure of it sometimes causes it to be that. sort of the nutshell soundbite approach is not easy to explain. I think also the media is not interested in somebody like me going about my business and having a normal life because I'm just not interesting enough, right?
Oh, come on. Well,
so
there's a point.
Often it's very hard. I'll just give an example. So often when I don't say what CNN wants me to say, they just don't put me on. So, for example, they called me up, and this has happened a couple times, but can I give an example?
Sure, please.
They called me up, and they said, you know, we've been following the story. There's a 17-year-old Muslim girl from Ohio who ran away from home, and her parents reported her missing, and she was found in, I think, rural Florida.
Uh-huh.
And now she won't come home because she ran away to a preacher and his wife whom she met on Facebook. And now she says she doesn't want to go home because she's converted to Christianity and her parents will kill her. Is she in danger? And I said, well, that's why we have court hearings to determine if people are in danger. And if they are, then you should help them.
Yeah.
Well. And she said, well, but does Islam put her in danger? And I said, no, you're not supposed to murder your children in Islam. And the CNN producer said, oh, well, we wanted a different answer. And I said, you know, you're not going to find an authority on Islam telling you that it's Islam puts her in danger from her parents. Yeah. And it sounds to me like a teenager complaint. God, my parents are going to kill me.
Right, well,
so,
yeah.
she said, okay, well, we just, you know, wanted some balance. So thanks anyway.
Well, yeah, I think, too, you know, the... at least they're ambitious, right? They're going to call some more people till they
find
what they want.
The right
but,
answer.
You know, yeah, exactly. I mean, newspapers and media sometimes are a rather blunt instrument as opposed to a scalpel. But Willow, did you have some thoughts? You have mentioned the media in your book, and I'm just curious what your thoughts are.
I think the problem with the media today is that it's very self-reinforcing. Mm. And I think part of that is not... so much because they're shadowy people who get together in a room and say, okay, what news are we going to spin today? I think it's because more and more people are not willing to pay for real journalism. So you get you get five wire reports that go out to every major newspaper in the world. They all build off of those. You know, stringers are getting cheaper and cheaper and cheaper and thus less and less and less, you know, informed mm-hmm. and educated about how to do their job. Yeah. And so I think part of the problem with the portrayal of Islam in the media is the way that the signal-to-noise ratio has just been degrading so much in the past few years in the media in general, and the over-reliance on wire reports, the closure of foreign desks, such that a lot of papers that now report on events in the Middle East and abroad do not have permanent reporters stationed in the places that they're reporting on. Which means they don't have people there who are in touch with the local culture and who know what's really going on. And so you get the number of voices gets smaller and smaller and smaller and less informed. And that's a big problem. I have run into similar things that Sumbo has described I was doing a report on one of the Guantanamo inmates who was trying to press a suit early on. This was years ago. And it was for a major newspaper that I won't say what it was, but right. I was told up front, you have to keep in mind that the editorial board is hawkish. Keep it in mind.
Wow.
Right, just like that, in those words. What else? You know, I've had...
That was a U.S. newspaper?
It was Canadian newspaper.
Oh, okay.
I don't know why they felt they had that much skin in the game. I mean, they're Canada, but, you know, whatever. but, you know, and also at a very major U.S. newspaper, I had an editor flat up tell me that I was crazy.
Well, that sounds like most newsrooms, but...
Yeah.
Right, I get your point.
But, you know, you do see the other side as well. I mean, it's not a completely bleak picture, and you do get... journalists who are generally interested in journalism as as a science and who want to get the story out there. And I don't want to downplay the work that they do, which is very important.
If I could just add, sure. Robert Fisk, who has been covering the Middle East for a long time, you know, I heard him say once that there is a particular frame in which you have to frame a story. There's a particular way in which you have to frame a story from the Middle East. And he says when he's tried to frame it in a different way, people truly don't understand what he's talking about.
Yep.
I mean, they're used to these triggers, and if they don't hear them, they don't really understand what he's trying to say. And I think if I had just a single complaint, if I had to just choose one of my complaints...
Oh, you just had 10.
Oh, I didn't. And like Willow said, I mean, there are wonderful journalists out there who are really trying, but very often they're also limited by their editors and their news desks and what goes on. And so, like, from my perspective, I've been asked quite a bit, well, why don't Muslims stand up and refute some of these things that are in the media? Well, you know, Muslim organizations issue press releases all the time condemning terrorism, for example. They don't make it onto CNN. They don't make it onto the news desks. But if I had one complaint, it would be that for a long time, and I think things are getting better, but for a long time, and still mostly, whenever a Muslim does something, it's always a function of Islam. You know, when other when people of other religions do something, it's because they're human beings. You know, human beings do things. They speed on the freeway. They commit crimes. They do all sorts of things, not always because of their religion. They don't always consult their religious texts before they speed on the highway. But with Muslims, you know, it's always a function. I'm still waiting for the news report that says that, you know, Muslims speeding on the highway because Islam says it's okay.
Well,
I'm sorry, I couldn't resist.
No, no, you could probably find that if you Googled it. But you know, I think Willow's point's important too. Not to make excuses, but the downsizing of newspapers and particularly any foreign coverage. From the U.S., the Mercury has been downsizing for years, and we finally closed our last foreign bureau a couple years ago, San Francisco. But I was wondering, could each of you talk a little bit about your writing routine or how you inspire yourself on a day-to-day basis to write? I'm kind of fascinated about this, and I may be the only one, but I've got the microphone and the big deck of cards, so... Do you have a certain place you write, or how do you do it?
I have spent my entire professional life writing at the dining room table. I've never had a desk. In the beginning, it was because my husband and I were starting out and didn't have space for a desk. And then I just sort of got used to it, and so, you know, I do it to this day. For me, writing is sort of a compulsion. It's something that I would be doing even if I was not doing it professionally. It's my big creative outlet. It's the way I process things. And so for me, it's really just about when I have the time, especially now that I have a baby, as soon as I have the time to write, that I sit down and the inspiration has to be right there. I can't wait for it. I can't, you know, say, well, gee, I'm just not feeling it today. You know, every time you want to do something professional, there's no such thing as I'm just not feeling it today. You know, you have to treat it like a job. And so for me, sitting down at my computer is showing up for work because that's literally how I put food on the table. And it's really, what's neat to me now is having done this for money for like 8 years now, is that now it is kind of automatic. You know, knock on wood, I don't get very much writer's block. Or if I do, I just sort of put something aside and work on something else.
Uh-huh.
And so it's what is really... been very gratifying to me as a writer is to get to that point where the writing just sort of flows on its own and I'm just kind of typing.
Yeah, that sounds pretty good.
Most days.
And how do you do it with, you know, balancing everything and all that?
Well, you know, it used to be a creative outlet for me until I went to law school. I have to say, and lawyers out there, law school kind of beat the creative side out of me in some ways. But I finished my book when my daughter was 4 and my son was 7. And so I had to do it at night, and if my husband could take them on weekends and during during nap time. Yeah. So it was a very kind of a scattered. And you try to take a four-year-old to the graduate library to do research. It's just it's just not easy. So the internet really helped.
Right.
And for me, both of my books. I have another one coming out in August.
What's that called?
It's called Growing Up Muslim, and it's for ages 10 and up. And it was actually inspired because when I was doing my book tour, so many middle school teachers came up to me and said, you know, we have to teach world religions, and there's nothing age-appropriate out there on Islam. And so could you please write something? So
that sounds great.
I did. So both of my books have been not so much from creative impulses, but from necessity. I felt like after 9/11, my husband said, you need to finish your book because if you don't, somebody else will.
Yeah, and you hoped somebody would, right? But it
was just you. I knew it was just me. Yeah. So I had to finish it. And then this book also, they said they wanted it in 3 months, and so I wrote it.
Wow. So. And Willow, you have a book coming out too, right?
I do. It comes out in July. It's a novel. It's called Aleph the Unseen. Huh. It grew out of a lot of the stuff that didn't end up in the Butterfly Mosque, about social media and about the role that it was starting to play in the Middle East and in facilitating conversations between different peoples that couldn't really talk before.
Well, that's interesting, yeah.
And, but when I tried to sort of pitch these chapters to people, they'd be like, Facebook, Twitter, really? Is it really going to be that important in the Middle East? They are eating their words now. But so I said, you know what, if I can't put this in nonfiction, I'll put it in fiction. And so I wrote this book in just sort of just a burst after I was finished with Butterfly Mosque. And I finished it a week before the Egyptian Revolution.
Wow.
It was one of the weirdest, most eerie, life-imitating art things that has ever happened to me. It was really, really, because I thought, you know, even I am exaggerating the importance of this thing, but it turns out I wasn't. So that was nice.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, my small residual I'll take off the air, but from the book plugs. But have you guys read or seen or read about? Well, I know Willow has Love Inshallah, the collection of maybe you should describe it. It's a collection of Muslim women writing on sexuality. Right?
Writing on their own experiences with love and sex and falling in love and getting married. It's a very eye-opening book, even for me. There was stuff in there. You know, I've been in the community my whole adult life, and there was stuff in there that shocked me. And it's the two editors, co-editors, are right here in the Bay Area. It's a fantastic book and very much worth reading.
And it's just out, right?
Yeah, just I think a couple weeks ago.
Have you heard much about that? Or
I know of it, and I've met the authors, but I have not read it yet.
I'm just wondering whether you think that will help, would contribute to breaking down some stereotypes, or it may not be fair to talk about it if you haven't read it, but
it broke down my stereotypes. I mean, I had, you know, it's. I don't know what it's like to grow up Muslim. You know, Islam is something that I adopted as an adult. And it was, in a way, it was reassuring for me to read that really, you know, the childhoods of Muslim women unfold pretty much like everybody else's. You know, like
right.
they learn about sex through kind of strange ways that you know, the same way that we do when, you know, you're on the playground and somebody says, did you know XYZ and blah, blah, blah.
Right.
It's something
yeah.
totally wrong and... But that's in your mind for the next, you know, X years until you get to health class. And it was very, yes, well, no, I've said too much probably. But it
no,
was,
go on.
You know, there were other things that were interesting for me to read that I was not expecting. I mean, there's at least one story in there by a woman who is completely veiled and is a lesbian. And that blew my mind. I mean, I know they existed, but I never expected anybody to write about it. I was like, this is like, I mean, yeah, it was really amazing to me. And she was very candid, this is not a woman who took faith lightly at all. It's you know, this is a deeply committed, conservative Muslim woman who says, you know what, this is what I am, and this is what I am, and those are the two things that I am. And so it was... Yeah, I mean, I discovered that I still had stereotypes about Muslim women.
Right, right.
I do not have anymore.
Oh, interesting. Well, I've been feeling a little guilty about not getting to some of these audience questions. You know, Catholic, remember? So, but this one actually is right on, it's on the veil thing, so it's kind of on topic here. And maybe some bulk could take the first crack at this. Why does Willow wear a veil on her head and Sumbal doesn't?
I knew someone was going to ask that.
You were right.
Why don't you answer that?
What?
Why don't you go first?
You know, the title of the subtitle of my book, it comes from my chapter on women, which is the longest in my book, which is called Women in Islam, Marriage, Divorce, Polygamy, and That Veil Thing. And that's kind of how people thought of it growing up. So, could you explain that veil thing?
Uh-huh.
And that's how I wrote about it. And in fact, you know, as Willow knows, the publishers have control over. This is just a small digression, I promise. The publishers have control over the title and the cover of the book. The author doesn't. And so they had chosen The Muslim Next Door for my book early on. And they showed it around to people, and the reaction they got was, "The Muslim Next Door?" And so they thought, oh, that's too scary. That's too scary.
It's a Tom Clancy novel.
So then they put in the subtitle, and picture of a friendly-looking person on the front. But anyway, so why does Willow wear his scarf and I don't? Well, the thing that is easy to not understand about Muslims is what a huge variety of interpretations and practices there are in Islam. You know, the very nature of Islamic law, and this is kind of a misnomer, but so I use it with some trepidation. But one of the whole premises of Islamic law is that there can be debates and arguments and contradictory opinions, all of which can be valid. So in Islam, there are four main Sunni schools and one main Shia school, and there are others as well. Schools of thought, or schools of law, they're called sometimes. And the significant thing is that they all consider each other equally valid, even when they contradict. So, for example, the Maliki school says that it says that you can pay a rent as a percentage of your crops, for example. Most of the other schools say you can't because this is an uncertain amount. You don't know how much your crops you're going to have, so you don't know how much the percentage of the crops is going to be, and it has to be a specified amount. But the Maliki school said, you know, we've been doing this in Africa for a long time, so we're just going to allow it. So this is two contradictory things, right? One allows it, one doesn't, but they're both equally valid. As a Muslim, you can go with either interpretation, and that is okay. So with respect to women's dress, what is the most important stricture in Islam is that both men and women have to be modest. The Quran doesn't say specifically what you have to do, but there are three verses that deal with modesty and some aspect of clothing, and these have been debated for a very long time. The classical jurists, they had a variety of opinions on this. Most of them said that women should cover their hair. Some of them said they didn't have to. Very few of them said they should cover their faces. There was all this debate. And what they came up with were parameters. They all agreed that the chest down to the knees has to be covered. But they didn't agree on the other things. So, for example, even the ones who said only the hands, face, and feet should show, they argued about what constitutes hand. Is it hand to the wrist or hand to the elbow? Only feet can show. Well, does that mean just the foot or a foot up to the ankle or a foot up to the knee? If you wear a headscarf, does that mean it has to start here or can it start back here? Does the neck? Okay, the chest has to be covered. Well, does the chest start at the neck or at the cleavage? All these things were discussed and debated. There is evidence that in early Islam, women prayed with their heads uncovered. Although now you don't see that. Everyone covers their hair when they pray. So there's always been debate on this issue. Generally, the consensus was that women should cover their hair. That was the sort of what most jurists agreed on. But that was also tempered by culture and hardship. So the scholars also agreed that if a woman was working in the fields, then she didn't have to be as covered up as other women whose clothing wouldn't get in the way of their livelihood. All these things were taken into account, custom, hardship. At that time, of course, in the 7th century and 8th century, most people did cover their hair, men and women, especially in the desert. It was hot. So what's interesting is that just recently, I think a few years ago, there was a big public debate in Egypt, which you may have seen, between the Grand Mufti of Al-Azhar University and the head of the Sharia court. And the public was very riveted on this, and they had a big scholarly public debate on whether covering the hair was a religious duty for women. One of them said it was, the other one said it wasn't. So as a Muslim, what am I supposed to do? I have two learned scholars, highly qualified, highly respected religious jurists, each saying different things. Well, who do I follow? In Islam, I can choose which one to follow. When I was doing one of my book talks, a woman came up to me afterwards and said she was from the Jesuit tradition.
Oh, yeah.
And she said, she said, in the Jesuit tradition, there is a sin of presumption, which is that if you have two learned, qualified religious scholars, and they say two different things, it is a sin of presumption to say that one is right and one is wrong. And
those Jesuits.
Are those the Romans or the Irish?
A little of both, usually.
So I think of that as I think of that as Islamic too, in some ways. There are lots of different scholars. You can choose which one to follow and be perfectly valid. So, Willow's decision to wear a headscarf is perfectly valid within Islam, and my decision not to wear one is valid as well.
Well, I'd love to ask you why you choose to wear a headscarf, but I think I need to get to another audience question, which is very good, and runs along the lines of something I was thinking. You know, you're both very much out there on a topic that is one of a lot of contention in the United States. And so, given that some people may not have a deep understanding or even appreciation of Islam, how do you deal with people who are antagonistic toward you? And I guess I would wonder, are people antagonistic toward you? What do you hear from people, and how do you deal with it?
There is a certain amount of antagonism. I sometimes get crazy stuff through my website. My favorite one, which I have starred in my inbox, is this one that's written in multicolored font. It's like purple and blue and green and red, and it's just a crazy person who says, the Muslims, the communists, and somebody else, and Obama are all in this kind of conspiracy to like overthrow the world. I was like, wow, that's some interesting. Jeez. Anyway, I have to say, I don't get a ton of hate mail. It happens.
Mm-hmm.
Since I've been back in the U.S., I went for about 6 months without covering my head because I was sort of afraid of the backlash. And I came back thinking that, how many years after 9/11 was it? 5 years after 9/11, things
right.
would have calmed down and get better. And I was shocked to find that they'd gotten worse.
Mm.
And so I was like, well, enough of this. If I could pass, I'm going to pass.
Mm.
And 6 months in, I decided to put it back on because it was... it felt like capitulating. This is not America where people have to hide their religion. And
right.
So I recovered, as I call it. Give it a second, you'll get it. Anyway, so...
It's a visual.
It's a visual pun. I keep waiting for somebody to tell me to go back to home, which is Colorado,
right,
or something like that. And it has not happened yet. The one time I was genuinely afraid was when I was at Trader Joe's. Oh my God, this is so middle class white liberal. I was at Trader Joe's. I was in the elevator going from the parking garage to the store, and there was this trucker guy there with like a pallet full of stuff he was taking in. He was looking at me with this look that was like, I was like, oh God, here it comes. It had to happen sooner or later. But he just said, kind of hot out, isn't it? And I said, I love it. It's like real summer, which we don't get often in Seattle. And he, because all Seattleites have this, like, Stockholm syndrome about the weather, was like, well, I can't wait for it to get cloudy again because it's too hot. And that was the end of the conversation. So, you know, I'm probably jinxing myself, but by and large, I mean, it's usually when people make comments, it's trying to be nice, like also at Trader Joe's a couple of weeks ago.
Spend a lot of time
there. I do. Probably unhealthy amounts of time. A woman came up to me and asked me which kind of hummus was more authentic.
Oh, there you go. They'll have you working giving out samples soon.
Yeah, I really didn't know what to tell her. I just said that I hadn't tried the one that was in her left hand that had tofu or something in it. I don't know. But really, I've been amazed by the number of people that actually go out of their way. And I think the hummus woman was one of them, actually. She was like, what do I have in common with this person? Hummus, right? So it's really, really touched me, the number of people that actually go out of their way to be nice, which are far, far more than the people who send crazy multicolored hate mail.
Right, right. Well, Sambol, in your book you had the episode where you'd gotten the package from Amazon.
Oh, yeah.
I think it was Toward Understanding Islam
was the book I ordered, yeah.
And there was I don't know if it was in Sharpie or something, but a message written on there that just said, go home, right?
Yeah, it was Amazon shrink wraps the books and they send them in the box. And so I opened the box and on top of the shrink wrap, it was written in big letters, go home. And it was a book called Toward Understanding Islam. And so I told Amazon, look, this is what I got. And they said, well, we'll investigate it with other such incidents.
Wow.
Oh,
but,
boy.
I mean, did it have you wondering where you were supposed to go exactly? I mean,
yeah.
You were home,
I mean,
right?
I have no memories of any other home. So, I mean, I just, this is always, I grew up in L.A., which is actually my excuse for a lot of things.
We forgive you.
Yeah. But, it's funny. I'm not visibly Muslim. So sometimes when I hear statistics that most Americans have never met a Muslim, my first reaction was, well, how would you know?
Right.
And in fact, my dad always told me, never talk about religion, politics, or other people's children. And here I am, doing exactly what. So I still feel a little bit apologetic about it, talking about religion. But and now everybody knows because I'm on the cover of this book.
There you go.
And but generally, I agree with Willow. One of the things that I've learned after, or what I've seen after writing this book, is how wonderful people can be. I have gotten the most moving letters from people telling me that reading my book completely changed their worldview or inspired them to go meet a real live Muslim or visit a mosque or read more about Muslims. I mean, just deeply moving, some nasty stuff too, but some just wonderful, wonderfully deeply moving and generous letters. In fact, I have a dear friend who's in the audience whom I met because he wrote to me. And I wrote back, and then he wrote back. And then he came to one of my talks, and he's a dear friend of our family now. So it's, I've been very proud. I've been very proud. And, of course, there are difficult incidents. You know, when I was a lawyer, I remember it was a long time ago, and I had just started, and one of the partners sat me down and said, so why are Muslims more violent than other kinds of people? And here I was looking really nonviolent in my new suit and my new pumps and 25 years old.
So glad you didn't punch him.
So there has always been stuff like that. And so I think it's I've always been in a position where I had to explain things.
Right.
And so this book just sort of came out of my explaining a lot of stuff.
Huh. Well, that's good. You know, Willow, I was thinking next time you go to Jiffy Lube, you should probably get the deluxe oil change service where they check to see whether you got a GPS stuck under your chassis.
Oh, man.
But, yeah, I mean, what's it like to be tailed by the feds?
Oh, God. Well, it's not as subtle as people think, or at least the phone part isn't, because he's referring to an incident that happens in Butterfly Mosque, wherein my white Catholic Republican friend who had been teaching in Egypt was stopped by the FBI when he flew back home to Milwaukee. When he got off the plane, there were two agents there waiting for him. They took him to a room. They said they knew where he had eaten lunch in Cairo the week before.
Wow.
They wanted to know where his money to fly back and forth from Egypt was coming, because they had looked at his salary as a teacher, which was low, and said, "You can't afford these tickets." And his explanation was, "My parents pay for them." Obviously. So, they told him that they could take away his citizenship, which is, of course, a lie for now. They asked him who he was associating with in Cairo and if he knew any Muslims and what they did. And so he told them the name of the only two American Muslims he knew, which were me and one other kid that we'd known in college, who was a hapless computer geek. To his credit, as soon as he got home, the first thing he did was get on the phone and call me and said, "Look, this happened. I gave them your name. I'm sorry. They asked. I told them. I don't know what's going to happen. I'm really scared." And I heard this click. Yeah. And I was like, "But we're the good guys," which was the only thing I could think to say at that point.
Our time is running short, which is always kind of sad. But I was wondering if maybe I could ask you guys whether you see some reasons for hope that relationships between Muslims and non-Muslims, I mean, some of them are fine, of course, but that overall relationships might get better. You were surprised to feel that they were getting worse since 9/11, and I'm wondering if there's any reason to hope they might get better in the years to come.
It's kind of a tale of two cities since 9/11. I mean, 9/11 caused a lot of people to think, what is Islam all about? I mean, who are these people? I wasn't taught about Islam or any religion in school. So you have a large part of the American population who was never educated on this subject. And a lot of people after 9/11 did want to go out and learn more about Islam and Muslims. At the same time, there was a rise in the fear-mongering networks. The Center for American Progress came out with a report, which you might have seen, which actually goes back and documents. There are only about 5 individuals in their organizations, but they're funded by over $40 million in the last 10 years. I mean, very well funded. And what they do is generate misinformation about Muslims and funnel it to the public and to lawmakers. And it's had a very damaging effect. And it's bad for our country because, it affects all of us. Fear and hysteria, excessive fear and hysteria, are not a good reason for policy decisions. If people are misinformed, that's not healthy for our democracy, because democracy works when you have an informed public. Xenophobia is not good for the social fabric of America, which is a multicultural society, so it's bad for all of us. But I think most people since 9/11 have been trying. And look at this event. I mean, I'm so amazed that this is a wonderful event, and this whole program is a huge step forward, I think. So I sometimes feel like it's inevitable that we will have to learn to get along. The world is getting smaller.
Right. Wonderful event. Maybe we'll just end on that. That's pretty good. Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you.
I'm sorry you felt defensive about the media.
Well, I hope you all enjoyed this evening's program, and we look forward to seeing you at future Silicon Valley Reads events. Again, we'd like to thank our 2012 Silicon Valley Reads authors, Sumbul Al-Kalamani, and again, Sumbul wrote The Muslim Next Door, The Quran, The Media, and That Veil Thing. Yeah, you got it. And G. Willow Wilson, author of The Butterfly Mosque. And our wonderful and very funny moderator, Mike Cassidy. You can follow Mike in the San Jose Mercury News. And, of course, our generous corporate and community sponsors, and most of all of you for joining us tonight. Thank you.